I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the new film Red Tails, a glossy adventure about the U.S. military's first black aviators, soared above expectations when it earned $19 million in its opening weekend. We'll talk with one of the film's stars and one of the real pilots known as the Tuskegee Airmen in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to look ahead to the Republican primary in Florida. The winner-take-all contest will award 50 delegates to the top candidate, the biggest prize so far in the GOP race, and it comes as the race has narrowed and the remaining competitors are fighting for every vote. The front runners, Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney, are focusing on a key voting block, Latinos. So we decided to do the same. And the candidates made their pitches for those voters on the Univision television network yesterday. Here's some of what Mr. Romney had to say about immigration.
I am not anti-immigrant. I'm pro-immigrant. I like immigration. Immigration has been an extraordinary source of strength in this country. As you, I'm sure, know, immigrants form more businesses than do domestic-born Americans.
There's a lot at stake in the January 31st contest. Recent data from the Pew Hispanic Center, Latinos now comprise 13% of all registered voters in Florida and 11% of Republican voters. So we wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon Gary Segura, co-founder and principal of the polling group Latino Decisions. He's here with us in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Hi.
Also with us, Laura Wides Munoz. She covers Hispanic affairs for the Associated Press, and she's with us from Miami. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Gary, let's start with you. Let me just ask, you know, we're used to thinking of Latino voters in Florida as being largely concentrated in the Cuban-American community. Very conservative, very Republican. Is that still true?
It is decreasingly true. So over the last decade or two, the Florida Latino population has become increasingly diverse. Cubans are really only about 30 to 33% of the overall population, of the Latino population. They're still a larger share of the electorate because they're more engaged in politics, more likely to be citizens, but that number is dropping as well. So the influence of Cubans on Florida politics is on a long, slow decline.
On a long, slow decline. But what about within the Republican Party, which is what we're talking about right now?
Well, Cubans are concentrated in the Republican Party in Florida because of the historic anti-communism and the Castro issue. Again, Cuban exceptionalism on this dimension is starting to decline, in part because younger Cubans are more diverse. They're more likely to choose the Democratic Party than their parents were, for example. And I think over time, they're becoming more like other Latinos.
And you have new data because your group, Latino Decisions, came out with a poll about Latino voters in Florida and also nationwide. What are the top issues for Latino voters in Florida? And is that the same as it is nationally?
Yes. So Latino voters in Florida, Democrat and Republican, are remarkably consistent with Latino voters outside. There are two giant issues. The first, and obviously, is the economy and jobs. Everyone wants a job. Everyone wants a good economy. And so this is a quite worrying to many Latinos. And I think the government data on unemployment and declines in personal wealth suggest that Latinos have really taken it on the chin. So it's a very important issue nationwide and in Florida. And then the second issue would be immigration.
Laura Wides Munoz, tell us more about that, if you would. What are you hearing?
Well, I think it's really interesting what you're saying, because when you played that clip of Romney's speech, I was there and I spoke with the students who was at Miami-Dade College who were outside and what they thought of it. And I'll tell you that most of the students I interviewed who had participated were Colombian Americans, Venezuelan Americans, who were about to vote in their first election, which is a sign of the growing diversity in the Florida vote. That said, you know, Cubans are still the number one voters, and as much as they are sympathetic on the immigration issue to the rest of Latinos, that's not what they've said they're going to vote on.
What are they saying they're going to vote on? Is Cuba still number one?
No, and it really hasn't been for a long time. It's economics. You know, even among pretty hardline Cuban exiles who feel very strongly, except for a very small minority, it's the same as everyone else. I want to find out how I can ensure that my job's going to remain, how I can grow my business, how I can put food on the table for everyone else. What was interesting, I had a conversation with some folks in the diner the other day, Puerto Rican Republicans, and they were much stronger on immigration. They put that as their priority. They said, well, you know, they should be able to have a path to legalization, to become citizens and vote and have all the rights of citizens. But interestingly enough, and this really speaks to the larger truth, they hadn't voted in 8 years or longer. And Puerto Ricans, while they tend to be more independent and tend to put immigration as a higher priority, are far less likely to vote than Cubans in Florida.
We're looking ahead to the Florida primary, the Florida Republican primary. It's January 31st. We're focusing on Latino voters in Florida and learning what we can about their preferences and also nationwide. Our guests are Laura Wides Munoz, Hispanic Affairs writer for the Associated Press. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us is Gary Segura. He's co-founder and principal of the polling group Latino Decisions. Laura, stay with me for a minute on the immigration issue. You know, you recently wrote about how Florida Latino voters view Mitt Romney's position on the DREAM Act. Now, that would create a path to citizenship for a very specific group. These are people, kids who were brought here as young children and who are want to go to college, serve in the military, and there would be a kind of a smoother path, you know, for them, the argument being it wasn't their decision to come here, you know, outside of authorization. These are people who are going to, you know, play a role in the future of the country. Romney has come out against that. How is that playing?
Well, again, it's something that even Cuban Americans tend to support, like other Latinos, very much. They see, you know, young students who are trying to better themselves, working hard, that they believe they should be rewarded. At the same time, people are worried about their jobs, and if they have to pick a priority, they're going to vote on the economy. And I think that was laid out. Lincoln Diaz-Balart, who's been a champion, he's a congressman from South Florida here, and he's been a champion of the DREAM Act and other immigration rights efforts for immigrants. And he said very frankly, I disagree with Romney on this, but I am backing him because I agree with him on so many other points, and chiefly the economy.
Gary Segura, what does your polling show about how Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts, is doing?
He's actually doing better than you would have expected among Latino Republicans who intend to vote in a primary. He's still outpolling Speaker Gingrich, even though Gingrich has this reputation of being more interested in engaging the Latino community. And part of that is consistent with what we just heard, which is that all of the South Florida Republican representatives have really embraced Mitt Romney.
And why is that?
I think it's in part because Latino Republicans are more moderate than most other Republicans in general, and you would have expected ideologically otherwise that they would have embraced Mitt Romney. They certainly also want to win. I do think that after their endorsement, when he came out and promised to veto the DREAM Act, it did put the Diaz-Balarts and Ileana Rosletten and others in a somewhat uncomfortable position. But that said, it is clear that Romney's promise to veto the DREAM Act has hurt him among Latinos nationally. And when we move out of the primary process and into the general election, that is going to be hung around his neck repeatedly by Democratic operatives.
Laura, what about Marco Rubio, the newly elected junior senator from Florida, very attractive candidate, widely touted as a possible vice presidential pick for somebody? Where does he stand?
I just wanted to follow up on one thing Gary said, which is that I just on the ground talking to folks over the last week, I've seen a significant shift even since last Friday in terms of confidence and strong support for Romney among Cuban exiles. Last week it was Romney, he's the guy who can win. This week it's, you know, that guy with the gray hair, Gingrich. I'm taking another look at him.
And so, he supports the DREAM Act?
He doesn't either. Both of them support a law that would allow people to join the military and become citizens, but not complete college and get a path to citizenship.
So his position isn't that different?
It's not that different, but he didn't come out and say, I would veto it. And that was something that Romney did, which really struck people as sort of, why do that? Why go that far? And also Romney's been campaigning with one of the architects of one of the strongest and harshest laws, the SB 1070 in Arizona.
And there was also an ad campaign directed at Romney, at Mitt Romney briefly, by Newt Gingrich, which hammered him as taking an anti-immigrant stance, as I understand it. That ad has since been taken down, apparently.
Which is a great segue to Rubio, because it has been taken down, in fact, at Rubio's asking, who said, look, you know, people have different views on immigration. Let's stop calling people racist because they don't support the DREAM Act. Let's talk about it more civilly. And that really speaks to Rubio's influence within the GOP party, as well as the delicate line he's walking on issues of immigration of great importance to Hispanics.
Has he endorsed, though?
He has not endorsed. We don't expect him to. And while he is considered a great catch as a vice presidential candidate for many reasons, he's also very new. He's been in Congress less than a year. And I think there's some idea that he would need to be vetted a little bit more. Also, he's very young. He's 40. Even if he sat out the next two elections, he'd still be a pretty young candidate if he decided to run at the top of the ticket.
And that's a good place to end. Gary, I'll ask you the final question. In the general election in 2008, President Obama won more than 60% of Latino votes, despite the fact that earlier in the primary, there had been all this talk about how, you know, Latinos wouldn't vote for an African-American and all this other stuff, which all of which sort of proved untrue. Talk to me a little bit about how you see the general election shaping up. And obviously, given that, as we said, that Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney don't seem to be very different on the question of immigration, although there are differences in how they're viewed in terms of the economy. So just handicap it for us, if you would.
Sure. In 2008, as you mentioned, the exit poll showed Barack Obama getting about two-thirds of the Latino vote. And the question this time is, are Latinos sufficiently disappointed in the absence of comprehensive immigration reform and their current economic positions so that they would lose their enthusiasm? But Latino enthusiasm for the Republican Party is really approaching an all-time low. A huge percentage of respondents in our polls tell us that they think the Republican Party either doesn't care about them or is actively hostile to their interests. And, of course, they have some pieces of information to build that on. So the question for handicapping the 2012 is, though Latino vote preference would overwhelmingly tilt towards the Democrats, I would say, again, at least two-thirds, will they turn out and vote? And I think that's largely going to be driven by the content of the campaign.
Gary Segura is the co-founder and principal of the polling group Latino Decisions. He was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Laura Weitz-Munoz covers Hispanic affairs for the Associated Press, and she was kind enough to join us from NPR member station WLRN in Miami. Thank you both so much for joining us. Keep us posted.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, Happy New Year, Lunar New Year, that is. The celebrations are underway, mainly in Asian countries, but around the world, and parades, food, and fireworks are on tap. We're going to take a look at how one multicultural family that includes two American-born parents and four adopted Chinese daughters celebrates the holiday. That conversation is just ahead. But now we want to take a look at a film that's bringing new attention to a largely unsung group of American heroes. There have been hundreds of books and dozens of films devoted to the Greatest Generation, those Americans who fought in World War II, but few of those stories have depicted the experience of the legendary Tuskegee Airmen, the U.S. military's first black aviators. That is changing. There have been some documentaries and made-for-TV films, but now the story gets the blockbuster treatment with the movie Red Tails. It's in theaters now. The story is set in World War II Italy, and its dazzling special effects recreate dogfights between the all-black air unit and their German enemies.
Come on, slip just a little.
Congratulations, Captain! You are the first Negro to shoot down a Jerry!
Between battle scenes, though, the film touches on the battles the pilots had to fight on the ground to prove that they had the right stuff at a time when high-level public officials and average citizens believed that black people were inferior. The film, despite the challenging material, brought in more than $19 million when it opened last weekend, number two at the box office on opening weekend. Here to talk more about this is David Oyelowo, who plays Joe Lightning Little, one of the stars of the film. Also with us is Roscoe Brown, a former Tuskegee Airman who served as a squadron leader and flew missions during World War II in 1944 and 1945. I welcome you both. And Mr. Brown, of course, I want to thank you for your service.
Of course, I'm glad to have been able to have done it. One of the things that a lot of people don't realize, just how rigid segregation was at that time. People could tell you to your face that you couldn't do this. You couldn't go into a theater. You couldn't buy a house. You couldn't get in the Air Force. So therefore, what we did helped to break those barriers.
David, you know, you grew up in Britain. Did you know about, had you heard about the Tuskegee Airmen before the film?
To my shame, I knew nothing about the Tuskegee Airmen, but I like to say that at least I had the excuse of being British. But when I read the script and became obsessed with the idea of being part of telling the story, it was a shock to me that so many Americans, both white and black, didn't know about them either.
What did you like about your role? What drew you to it?
Well, for me, Joe kind of typifies the audacity of youth. He's completely fearless, that kind of fearlessness that we all remember, those of us who are older, when we were, you know, in our teens and early 20s, that feeling of invincibility, the idea of mortality is very, very far away from your thoughts. And, you know, what was so great about getting to spend time with Dr. Brown and Lee Archer and Bill Holloman, who were with us when we were shooting the film, is that even they were saying at times, we can't believe we did the things we did. And you know, when you watch the film and when you read about these guys' exploits, it takes a feeling of almost superhero-like invincibility to do what they did.
Wait, was there a real life Joe Little or a Joe Lightning on whom you modeled your character?
They often tell me that when I've been with Tuskegee Airmen, apparently I remind them a lot of an airman called Wendell Pruitt. I don't know if you remember him, Dr. Brown.
Yeah, I definitely do. Yeah. He's a pretty hot pilot.
See,
the fact
hot
is
pilot?
That we were all hot pilots. That means you're a great pilot who does really great things, come close to the ground, turns a plane upside down, does all those really fantastic things. And that's what we called a hot pilot. Wendell Pruitt was a hot pilot, Lee Archer was a hot pilot, I was a hot pilot. And we did things that sort of defied imagination. You came close to the ground, you cut the grass, you pulled up, you did things like that. That's why we were so confident, some people said arrogant, and I think we were very cocky is the word I like to use. We really felt we could do it because, see, we come from a generation of African Americans where we knew we had to be better than white people in order to even break through. Excellence was our mantra. That's what we were taught to be, and we were very competitive among each other. And some of that shows in the film between Easy and Lightning, the competitiveness to see who's going to be the best.
You know, you've given me a lot that I wanted to talk to you both about. And just to remind people, you served as a squadron commander of the 100th Fighter Squadron of the 332nd Fighter Group. And as we mentioned, there are lots of sequences in the film that depict these battle scenes, but also what these men were fighting for. And as David mentioned, you were a consultant on the film. Can I just ask you, what was some of the advice that you gave to the actors to bring them into the headspace that you had to be in at the time? Because you talked about the fact that you were cocky, but you know what? You were in a time when cockiness could get a black man killed.
Well, one of the things that I did was to show them how we stood, how we talk, how our shoulders were back, our uniforms were fixed up. And the other thing is, I showed them how fighter pilots sitting in a cockpit moved. You don't move with jerky movements, you move with smooth movements, but you're quick, you're looking around, you're alert all the time. And I taught them that, and when you see those pictures of David and Easy and all those guys in the cockpit, they moved like we did. They did a good job, and I think I did a good job of teaching. Isn't that right, David?
Yes, you did a very,
no
very good job.
No cockiness there.
Dr. Brown. You see, I didn't, for my character, I didn't need to go very far at all. I just needed to hang with Dr. Brown.
That's
to get
it.
The cockiness going.
Well, what was the best piece of advice that you think you got from Dr. Brown and the other consultants, the other pilots?
Well, to be honest, the best thing that we got from them was being around them. You know, you can read about these guys, you can watch documentaries, but to be literally able to go up to Dr. Brown or Lee Archer and say, what did you guys eat? How did you guys feel about what was going on back in America? What was it? What did it feel like, those blankets you used to lie on? Were they itchy? Were they comfortable? You know, just those little details that you can't read in books and often aren't going to be in a documentary. I remember one day approaching Dr. Brown about to get into a cockpit, and he ended up tightening my belt, you know, showing me how my shoes weren't quite right, pulling down on my helmet. And, you know, when you get in a cockpit, you know, a real Tuskegee Airman having just been effectively your costume supervisor, you really feel like you're in that role. So just having them around was such a blessing for us.
We're talking about the film Red Tails. It's in theaters now. It tells the story of the Tuskegee Airmen. It's a fictionalized account, but it's based on, you know, real events and real characters. And we're talking with one of the film's stars, David Oyelowo. He plays Joe Lightning Little. Also with us is Roscoe Brown. He flew missions in World War II. Mr. Brown also served as a consultant, you know, on the film. You know, Mr. Brown, you brought up a number of important points, which is this idea that you had to be, you know, the saying goes, twice as good to get half as far. And the film's executive director is the famous George Lucas, who financed the film with his own money. Of course, you know, quite successful due to the Star Wars and Indiana Jones, you know, franchises. But he was on Comedy Central's The Daily Show earlier this month talking about even with his reputation, how hard it was to get the film made. I'll just play that clip.
23 years. We finished it, financed it myself, and I figured I could get the prints and ads paid for by the studios and that they would release it. And
right.
I showed it to all of them, and they said, no. We don't know how to market a movie like this.
Why?
It's not green enough. There's no major white roles in it at all. It's one of the first all-black action pictures ever made.
So, David, I have to ask you this question. What do you make of that? And did you know about this as you were participating in the project? Were you ever, you know, worried that your time would be for naught?
Well, I didn't worry that my time would be for naught because we had George Lucas, and that's the difference this time round. The syndrome that he's talking about is one that every black actor, you know, working in Hollywood is very, very cognizant of, because, you know, often we are relegated to peripheral roles, token roles. Very rarely are you allowed to be the center of the story. The excuse that is often leveled is that, you know, a film which has a black lead will not have legs abroad, despite the fact that the biggest movie star in the world is Will Smith, despite the fact that we have Denzel Washington. These excuses are still leveled. So that was one of the exciting things for me, is that I knew that with George Lucas, I didn't anticipate the challenges even he faced, but I knew that this was a man who, he made Star Wars when no one else was doing sci-fi. He broke ground with American Graffiti with no-name actors, a film that went on to do huge box office. So, you know, for me, he feels and felt like the ideal person to Moses-like take us into the promised land. So, you know, God bless George Lucas.
But what about the film's message? I'm asking this in part because you're young man. You're not a baby, but you're young. Mm. And
yeah.
The message is one that we don't hear very often anymore, which is you have to be twice as good. You have to earn the right to be respected. Even if you shouldn't have to, you do. I mean, some of the most powerful scenes in the film, I mean, there are many, but have to do with people saying to these young men, you are fighting to prove your worth. You shouldn't have to, but you are. And I'm wondering if you think, forgive me for, you know, but that people want to hear that today.
Well, right? I think whether they want to hear it or not, it's a truism, whether you're black, white, a woman, or whatever. You know, Dr. Brown often would say to us that it's cool to be smart. That's the thing that he really would like young people to take away from this. But also, they overcame these adversities with excellence. They didn't spend their whole time carping about the inequities that they were suffering. They just were excellent at what they did. And with time, Truman, the rest of the country, had to acknowledge them. That's led to the desegregation of the military, which led to the desegregation of the South, which led to the civil rights movement, which led to us now having a country in which we can have an African-American president. So the message of the film is that, yes, everyone faces obstacles, whether it's bullying in a playground. It's about how you deal with those obstacles, and these men chose to do it by being excellent at what they were chosen to do.
I know you want to answer that, Mr. Brown. I do think it's worth mentioning that you went on to become a distinguished educator, and after being a distinguished aviator, you're now the director of the Urban Education Policy Center at City University of New York. So what about you? I mean, do you think that young people want to hear that?
I think young people want to hear it. One of the things that we face now is the proliferation of media. There's so many subsets in the media that bring us to a particular point. And the old days where you had four television stations and everybody listened to the same thing are gone. So therefore, we have to use various forms of communication. And one thing about Red Tails, by the way, Red Tails is because that's the color of the silver P-51 tail surfaces. They were shining red tails so the bomber pilots could recognize us, and they began to call us the Red Tail Angels because we stayed so close to them and protected them. But in terms of our young people today, many of the young people haven't had the harsh reality as I did when I came back from the service and applied to be a pilot at Eastern Airlines, where the secretary took my application, threw it in the wastebasket, and said to my face, "We don't hire Negroes here." We were powerless. We couldn't do anything about it. But because of our pursuit of excellence, and finally Harry Truman desegregated the military, and finally the Brown case, we have opportunities now, but you still have to prove yourself. And the way you prove yourself is to be smart, to be persistent, and to be disciplined. And I think this is one thing that young people will get from this movie.
I do have to ask, though, that one of the criticisms of the film is that it doesn't dig deep enough into the issues that you talked about, Mr. Brown. For example, the New York Daily News reviewed it this way, and I'm quoting here, George Lucas produced this candy-coated, fictionalized drama, and while its cast is first-rate and its flying sequence is sharp, the movie is as glazed and wide-eyed as a 70-year-old comic book. So, you know, Mr. Brown, I have to ask you that. I mean,
that's really an exaggeration. As a matter of fact, the reviewer who wrote that said we were escorting transport planes. He didn't even know that they were bomber planes. He, because of the dialogue in the movie that says we were doing things with each other, we weren't cussing each other out. We weren't cussing out white people. We were trying to be better. That was a very unfair review. I think some of the other reviews, such as in the New York Post and Times, were much better, and they contextualized it. And that's one of the problems we have. A lot of people in America think that things were always this way. They were not always this way, and they're not perfect yet.
Okay.
One of the things we want to do is to show excellence will help to overcome prejudice.
I do want to ask David about this whole question of excellence. There was a very, you know, aggressive word-of-mouth campaign, kind of grassroots campaign to get people to the film on opening weekend. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if, you know, looking back on it now, there were a lot of events. There was even an event at the White House. There were a lot of Tuskegee Airmen events. There was a lot of community support, major, you know, even civil rights leaders saying, look, you need to go out and see this film just to basically show Hollywood what's up. And I'm wondering if, looking back on it now, you know, was that really necessary? I mean, is it really the case that whatever problems George Lucas had getting the film made, is it really true that if this film didn't do well on its opening weekend, that, you know, Spike Lee wouldn't get to make another film, John Singletary wouldn't get to make another film?
The reason we had to go out and beat the drum is that this is a full-bore action movie in the vein of Top Gun, in the vein of Mission Impossible, in the vein of all those action films that both black and white people go to cinemas weekend after weekend to watch and enjoy and escape. And, you know, George Lucas's mantra for us when we were making this film is, I want to make a film about heroes, not victims. And the fact of the matter is we've had so many films that are centered around the black experience from a period point of view that are about us being subservient or us being browbeaten. So you know, we had to go out and let people know this is a celebration, not just of the Tuskegee Airmen, but of the fact that America joined the world in saving the world from Nazism, from a dictatorship. And, you know, in a world in which we all go and see Iron Man, Superman, Spider-Man, whatever, these were superheroes who saved the world, but there wasn't a cape in sight. And that needed to be told to everyone, and that's why they came out, because if we didn't tell them, they would assume this was a civil rights piece that makes us all feel bad.
All right, so Captain Brown, are you happy with it when all is said and done?
I'm happy, tremendously happy. I want people to come back this weekend, sit in that seat, because when you sit in that seat, you feel like you're in that airplane. So that's one of the things that's so great about the movie. And the other thing is, it just shows that excellence will overcome obstacles. And that's what we did, and that's what I want, you want our young people to do.
Roscoe Brown is a former Tuskegee Airman who served as a squadron commander of the 100th Fighter Squadron of the 332nd Fighter Group. He retired at the rank of captain. He's currently the director of the Urban Education Policy Center at City University of New York, and he was nice enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Also with us, David Oyelowo, who plays Joe Lightning Little. He is one of the stars of the film Red Tails, and he joined us from our NPR West studios in Culver City, California. Thank you both so much for speaking with us, gentlemen. Thank you for taking the time. And Captain Brown, I have to thank you once again for your service to this country.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, actor Demian Bichir was just nominated for an Oscar for his role in the film A Better Life, about the struggles of undocumented immigrants in L.A. We talked to him about the film, but he also told us about the music that inspires him. That's our In Our Ear segment, and it's coming up in a few minutes. But first, Gung Chi Fa Chai, or Happy New Year, which tens of millions of people are celebrating around the world with fireworks, parades, and of course, food. We're ringing in the year of the dragon, considered especially auspicious in Chinese culture.
The holiday is a special time for people who are connected to Asian culture, but in this country, many thousands of people have that connection through adoption. According to the U.S. State Department, since 1999, around 67,000 children have been adopted from China. And many of these families see the holiday as a chance to help their children learn more about Chinese traditions and culture. We wanted to hear more about one family's Chinese New Year story, so we're joined now by David Yutz and his daughter Sophie. David is the dad of four girls. They are all adopted from China, and Sophie is the eldest, and she's a junior in high school. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be here.
Hi.
David, you previously visited with us to talk about your family, your beautiful family. Just to remind people who didn't hear our previous conversation, which was part of our parenting segment, you and your wife are not Chinese. Your four daughters are Chinese, but you feel it's important to introduce them to a Chinese culture and traditions. Why do you think that's important?
Well, it's really important for a couple of reasons. It's very much who our children are. Of course, our kids have various different identities going on. So they are Chinese. They were born in China. To the outside world, they will look like Chinese people. They're Chinese American. And so there's a lot of interesting issues about how to help prepare them for being Chinese American in our country. And of course, we want them to feel a lot of pride in where they came from. I think that's especially important when you're an adopted person. So we want our kids to feel really grounded and proud of their ethnicity and proud of their own stories.
Sophie, what do you think about that?
I think it's really good that I have this opportunity to look deeper into my Chinese side, since even if we're living in America.
Well, your little sisters are a lot younger than you, but you've had a chance to kind of experience Chinese New Year for a while. Is there a favorite part of the holiday for you?
Typically, as a teenager, I love receiving hongbao, which is red packet where the parents usually put in money for their children to spend as they wish. It's a lot like Christmas for the Chinese, but I also really like the lion dance just because of its energetic feel and the story. One aspect of the lion dance was the man, the tamer, who really scared me with his big giant mask.
Okay. Tell us, David, tell us a little bit more about Chinese New Year, how it's celebrated, what it means.
Well, I think it's really two big things in Chinese culture. The first, of course, is that it's the start of a whole new year, starting a new cycle. And just like it is for the Western New Year, it's kind of a chance to look ahead, start over again, make wishes and plans and hope for really good luck. But the other thing that it is in Chinese culture, above all, it's a family holiday. So it's kind of like Christmas and Thanksgiving and New Year's all wrapped into one section or one part of the year. And then it's, it's a good 2 weeks of festivities if you're really doing it in the traditional way. And every day has different things going on. Some of them are just with your close family, and a lot of things are with your wider circles, your clan, your extended family, times that you go out and visit other friends.
Well, in China, obviously, which is such a big country, this two-week period would probably be a time when family members who are living apart from family or living across the country would probably try to gather. Wouldn't that be right? There's a lot
That's
of traveling
right.
back and forth to see family.
Yeah. We recently returned from living in Hong Kong for 4 years. And one of the incredible things that goes on there and even more so over the border is that people go to great lengths to get back to their home and to the wherever they call their extended family's home. So in China, millions and millions of people are on the trains and buses and on the roads trying to get home in the days right before the holiday.
So it is like Thanksgiving only writ large.
Yeah.
Really big.
1.3 billion people large.
Yes, 1.3 billion people large. If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with David Yutz. He's the father of four girls. They're all adopted from China. His eldest, Sophie, is with us, and we're talking about how their family celebrates Chinese New Year. So, Sophie, you, as your dad just mentioned, you've been celebrating the holiday in the United States, but you just got back, right, from Hong Kong, so you had a chance to compare. What did you notice about the differences?
I noticed how much more serious that this Chinese New Year is in living in Hong Kong. They had multiple Chinese dinners and brunches and festivals and lion dances and definitely the fireworks. That was a big one, too. You don't see that much in America for something like this.
Do you miss it now that you're back?
It's hard to say. I myself, I'm not really, yay, Chinese New Year. But living in Hong Kong, it has broadened my knowledge on it. So it's made me think of it more as a value than a time to get away from school.
You know, but one aspect of the celebration, as I understand it, is that it's a time to pay respect to the ancestors. And Sophie, did you mind if I ask, is that part of it hard for you? Do you think about that? Is it a bummer at all or no?
Well, I haven't really thought about it until actually this past Sunday when my family went to this Chinese banquet in Flushing, Queens. And the host had said that all the children should bow 3 times to their ancestors before receiving Hong Bao from their parents. I've never heard of this really before, so I didn't want to participate in it, only because I don't know who my Chinese ancestors are. And it seems to me that if I bow to someone who I don't know or haven't heard about, it just seems fake to me.
David, what do you think?
Well, yeah, I guess I've always known in the abstract that this was an important part of the festival. And for our Chinese American friends, you know, it's very real and really important. In our family, it's a little more complicated. You know, for my kids, which ancestors are we talking about? They're my wife and me. We have all kinds of ethnicities going on, Irish and Swiss and English and Scottish. And so my kids know about that, and they know their grandparents. But on the other side of their heritage, it's pretty much unknown. We don't really know much about the birth parents and the birth families. And in our family, we frequently talk about the birth parents or recognize them. We thank them on our kids' birthdays, for example. But it was a little bit startling and interesting when the local Chinese host, this was actually the city councilman for the borough of Queens, Peter Koo, had all the kids look up at a big Chinese scroll with big Chinese characters and asked them to bow 3 times and repeat 3 sort of honorary and appreciative statements to the ancestors. So a lot of the kids were, you know, down to age 3 or 4 or 5, and they immediately did that. And then some of the teens, I think, were having a little more complicated experience.
Because they're Americans.
That's right.
It's our job to question.
It felt a little unusual for Americans to do.
It's our job to question, right, Sophie? Tell them.
Yeah.
That's right. Let's talk about what really matters, the food. Thanksgiving, of course, in this country is the turkey, and then New Year's has other traditions, like some celebrate with, you know, black-eyed peas and rice and collard greens for prosperity and black-eyed peas for health. So is there a special food that you must have on Chinese New Year?
I would say dumplings and noodles are the big things. The Chinese really like symbols, so there's a little round dumpling, and it's shaped kind of like a gold pouch. And then there's the ones that we usually see that are kind of crescent moon-shaped, and that symbolizes the shape of gold nuggets that they used to use for payment, I think. And as for noodles, since they're long, they symbolize longevity.
Good. David, anything you want to add?
Well, I know there are so many more. Chinese, like lots of cultures, make food the center of everything. So food and giant extended banquets are a big part of how we celebrated in Hong Kong. And everything has a meaning. So my memory of all these Chinese banquets is there's always someone pointing to something and saying, oh, you have to eat this or eat this in a certain way or serve your parents this. Everything has these meanings. But frankly, it's just about massive amounts of really fantastic food.
Okay. Well, for those of us who are not Chinese, how would you recommend that we participate if we want to get a part of this experience? I know, Sophie, you would recommend Hong Bao, definitely, right?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get somebody to give me some Hong Bao, but somehow it doesn't seem to be working, but I don't know.
Maybe you have to bow to them 3 times.
Well, I'll try.
I think, you know, it's a really interesting question for families like ours. We sort of select what feels comfortable to us because we don't want it to feel artificial. But at the same time, we're an American family living in New Jersey. We want to try to find a balance. So we take some of the things that we think are really important, and we clean the house. We frequently buy new clothes. That's one of the big things Chinese people do. We often put out orange trees, and we want to make the house feel sort of festive so that everyone's feeling like we're taking this seriously and it's important to us. But there are other parts that we don't really do, or they don't quite fit our kind of family. So, you know, I think all of the kids now who've been adopted from China, and then on top of that, an even larger number of kids who've come from Korea and Vietnam and elsewhere, I think all of those families have found their own personal ways to bring that cultural moment into their families' lives. I think it's wonderful the way it's changed our families. We are, in a way, a whole new version of being Chinese American.
Finally, this is the year of the dragon, which has a lot of meanings, but one of them is optimism for the family. So, David, what is your wish for your family on this new year?
I think optimism is a great word for us this year. We're recently back from living in China, so we're sort of finding our feet again being here in America. And I think it just happens in our circumstance, we're really looking forward. We have a good feeling about the year of the dragon, so here's hoping it'll be a strong and good one.
Sophie, do you have a special wish for your family?
I guess just to be happy.
Sounds good. David Yutes and his wife, Mary Child, are the parents of four daughters who were all adopted in China, including his oldest, Sophie Yutes. David and Sophie were both with us from NPR New York. Thank you both so much, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
恭喜发财.
Now it's time for the occasional feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we ask some of our guests about the music that inspires them. Today we're going to hear from an Oscar nominee. Months before Demian Bichir was nominated for the Best Actor Academy Award, he spoke with us about his starring role in the film A Better Life. And he also told us about the songs that make his life better.
Hi, I'm Demian Bichir, and this is what's playing in my ear.
When you were here before, couldn't look you in the eye. You're just like an angel.
I love this song by Radiohead called Creep. Maybe because I feel like one many times.
I wish I was special. You're so very special. But I'm a creep. I'm a widow.
I think what I like about this song is that, of course, the lyrics and the pace of the rhythm and the whole instrumentation. This is a fantastic group.
I don't belong.
There's this wonderful songwriter, Silvio Rodriguez, Cuban songwriter, Silvio Rodriguez. When I was a kid, one of my first concerts was to see Silvio performing, and it was really amazing that it was only one guy with a guitar and an auditorium filled with, I don't know, 3,000 people, and there is particularly this song that was the first that I heard from him. It's called Ojalá.
La palabra precisa, la sonrisa perfecta. Ojalá pase algo que te borra de pronto. Una luz cegadora, un disparo de nieve. Ojalá por lo menos que me lleve la muerte.
Ojalá que la aurora no te condena. Something like that. And it's a really beautiful song that speaks about, you know, many things. Maybe a woman, maybe politics, maybe a state of mind, maybe an emotion.
Para no verte siempre en todos los segundos, en todas las visiones.
I've been sitting around for way too long.
My third favorite song that's on my ear these days is called Horses on the Range.
And I just have to say, let me run like the horses on the range. And I promise you I'll never, ever complain.
It talks about these chains that we all carry sometimes and how much we need to get rid of them in order to be able to ride on the range like the horses and be and free ourselves from our own demons and ghosts. And it's a really powerful, beautiful song with a really nice pace.
These chains that are holding me make it so hard for me to breathe.
That was Oscar-nominated actor Demian Bichir talking about the music that's in his ear, including this song by Timmy Curran, Horses on the Range.
Once I get out, I'm gonna run like the horses on the range. And I promise you I'll never, ever complain.
And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bracton Booker, Bridget DeShagas, Eamon Malone, Sanaj Meshkinpour, Emily Oxenschlager, Amitha Parasher, and Amy Ta. Our intern is Bridget Armstrong. Our editors are Alicia Montgomery and Ahmad Omar. They had help this week from Lori Grant. Our special thanks to NPR's librarians. Our director is Arjun Hutchins. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Neil Tevolt. He had a hand this week from Kurt Stoniker. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. Our executive producer is Tashima Walker. And remember to tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can find our podcast there. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at TellMeMoreNPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.